You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Ben Comore. Ben, it's good to have you with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Eric. Very much appreciate the opportunity.
So, Ben, the way we start the show is to just ask, who are you? It's a way of getting the conversation going, and we will get to know each other over the course of the hour.
So, I guess I'd have to say I'm many different people to...
To different people.
Yeah. I'm a brother, I'm a son, I'm a nephew, I'm a grandchild.
Uh-huh.
I guess I view myself as someone with a lot of curiosity and someone who has the potential, if I have the right relationships, to bring a lot of empathy, I feel like, to what I do. I'm very much, I guess I have to say, I love to do intellectual things in general.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a bit preoccupied by philosophy when I get such a question. So I guess I don't know, I'm just another citizen who's trying to make his way and do the best that I can.
Uh-huh. And you described yourself as interested in intellectual things, but also capable of great empathy. And I think that's a neat combination. And I hope we can go more into that in the course of the hour. You brought some music, and you wanted to start with Frank and Jesse James by Warren Zevon. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say anything about that piece before we play it, or you want to wait till after we're done?
Well, I can say something. It holds a lot of sentiment for me. I listened to it a lot when I was young with my father. And I think that particularly the fading piano part speaks to kind of the detachment we can experience while relating to others. And then there's sort of like a just / hardworking tone in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we go. Frank and Jesse James by Warren Zevon.
James. Jesse James. Well, Frank and Jesse James. Keep on riding, riding, riding till you clear your names. Keep on riding, riding, riding across the prairies and the plains. Keep on riding, 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 Frank and Jesse James.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Ben Comore. Ben, so I'm just going to say this because you are about college age, and usually the people I interview on the show tend to be older, okay. but not always. And I just say that as a way of giving some context to, you know, when I ask the question, what are the experience that has helped to define your life or at this point, because you are in your early 20s, mm-hmm. and from the place where you stand now, you know, what experiences have been the major things that have helped to define your life?
Well, I'd have to say I had many major negative experiences in my 22 short years on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
I was exposed firsthand to some individuals when I was a young child who were very mentally ill. Mm-hmm. I was diagnosed with Burkitt's lymphoma when I was in sixth grade, which is it's a form of cancer, and I,
wow.
Yeah, so yeah, so yeah, that was fairly difficult.
So, and before that, you had been had a person in your life who was severely mentally ill.
Yes, yeah, so at least one person.
Yeah.
And it hurt a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, before I was diagnosed with lymphoma, I was very much overweight, and so I was picked on a lot because of that. After I recovered from lymphoma, I was doing pretty well, but then I started dabbling in drugs and alcohol, and essentially that preoccupation ruined a lot of my high school career. When I finally realized, you know, what matters in this life, which I would say, at least from my perspective, is thinking, critical thinking, understanding people, genuine social relationships, and taking care of family and friends. So when I finally understood that, it was very late, and it's unfortunate because I feel like a lot of teenagers these days don't have much of in some ways support. And their primitive part of the brain, the limbic system, is very overactive, and particularly in teenagers, and the cortical region, which deals with executive function, is not as developed.
Mm-hmm.
So I was immature, and there was probably a biological basis to it, but I just decided that I would do the best that I could from when I stopped doing such maladaptive things.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And it was a lot harder, in fact, to be able to get into a college that I wanted to, given that I didn't do very well, particularly in sophomore and junior year of high school.
Right, right.
And then there was another major wrench thrown in the picture. Because during my first semester of college, I very rapidly developed a fairly severe mental disorder, and people have called it different things. I've seen many different doctors, different psychiatrists, and I think the most accurate diagnosis would be something called schizoaffective disorder, which includes some psychotic elements and some mood elements.
Mm-hmm.
So particularly with me, it was about delusional thinking, and also having a depressed mood.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I've only recently been been recovering well from that in the past couple months. Going away to another college was a great experience for me. It mm-hmm. was very difficult in the beginning, but I powered through it with the help of an amazing psychologist, Dr. Theodore Papperman, who taught me how to battle potentially delusional / distortional thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm very stable. I take medication and supplements daily, but I'm very functional, and I don't see the sorts of limits that I used to see. I'm not as afraid of the world, and I'm a lot more directed. I like to mm-hmm. think of myself as a bit more objective and welcoming of all sorts of people.
Uh-huh. I want to go back to something that you said. It took you, you felt it was kind of late for you to learn the importance of critical thinking. And I think and that a certain kind of honesty and assessment that goes with critical thinking. And you were saying the value of relationships and taking care of yourself and being in relationship with family members and others. You, when you said that happened late for you, I just said, you know, I know a lot of people who haven't figured that out in their 30s and 40s and 50s, and some people who go to the grave late in life not really having understood that. So I felt both gratitude and a sense of respect and awe for the fact that you could figure that out and say that. And you figured that out after having kind of, were you able to drop out the drugs and alcohol before you went to college?
Well,
or was that self-medicating, or how was that?
Yeah. Without a doubt, there was an aspect of self-medication in it. I went to college, and during my first semester, I was clean. And then between semesters, I started doing some things again. And it was because largely I had an implemented structure in my life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And therefore I could not function well. So this break between semesters that I'm on now has been really great in that I am still being productive. I am still growing. I'm still watching out for my friends and family, particularly those who were with me during my darkest times.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And no doubt it's very difficult to be around an under-medicated or unmedicated person with a psychotic disorder. So I have to hand it to them, particularly my mom, who has always been with me. Basically, despite everything, she's the main reason why I've been able to achieve as much as I have today. I think that given that the brain is a muscle, that if it's used, then it gets stronger. And of course, there are parts of the brain and neurotransmitters that deal with things like empathy and altruism, I guess, which arguably doesn't exist, but just good faith towards other people.
Yeah.
And so I feel like a lot of individuals grasp that at some point in their life, and then for whatever reason, I don't know, drugs and alcohol, having a great loss in the family, like losing one's job, having one's spouse leave them or whatever, they kind of lose focus and mm-hmm. and they have a hard time getting back on track. And quite honestly, I don't think there's a lot of societal support for such individuals. So it really stinks.
Right.
It's horrible.
Right. Yeah. And I guess what I would want to know from your point of view is, what is the nature of support that's helpful in a situation like what you've been through versus what would be considered meddling or inappropriately being in a person's life who needed support? And I ask the question in that way because as a culture, we tend to have gotten more atomized and see ourselves as kind of isolated individuals, and we don't know how to be in each other's lives.
Mm, yeah.
So what is it that would help us to learn to offer or to be in a relationship? What do we need to know to be helpful?
Well, I think the first thing is that every person is unique. every mental illness is a little bit different from another's, despite the label they place on it.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of it is kind of feeling out, you know, what helps a person and what doesn't. I guess you can only know based on like their behavior.
Or you can, and you can ask, but you have to ask in a way that's kind and not judgmental.
Yeah. I mean, it's very difficult to, and I've had some, particularly one really great psychiatrist, Dr. Colin Doria, who basically never stopped kind of treating me with dignity and respect and as an equal, even when I was pretty far out there. So I guess, again, it's just so difficult. I think that, at least in my case,
mm-hmm.
what's helped is having support of friends and family, and then going to therapy regularly and taking medication. Those are basically three general pillars to recovery, which a very influential psychologist, Dr. Pavanelli, talked to me about. I could explain a little bit. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I want you to explain a little bit about what people have specifically done that's been helpful. And
I see.
Okay. Can we cut to the Avicii "Hey Brother"? Because I also want to get your music in.
Sounds good.
Okay. So, and do you want to say something about Avicii before we?
Sure.
Am I pronouncing it correctly?
I am actually not sure about that. But
okay.
Anyways, it was really an aha moment when this song came on. I was in the hospital. For all intents and purposes, it felt like I was incarcerated. It was a very serious place with lots and lots of very sick people. But I made one great friend, and we played like 5 games of chess every night, and he beat me almost all the time. This guy was very clearly a genius. But so I remember this song coming on, and we were sitting next to each other, and right after "Hey Brother," I looked at him and I'm like, wow, like, you're my brother. Like, we're sharing this experience. It's one of the first times during my recovery that I actually felt very, like, genuinely connected with another individual. So
that's powerful.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, here we go.
Hey brother, there's an endless road to rediscover. Hey sister, know the water's sweet, but blood is thicker. Oh, if the sky comes falling down for you, there's nothing in this world I wouldn't do.
Hey Brother, Avicii. And this is WRFI Watkins Glen Ithaca and the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Ben Comore. So Ben, you had described this as the first time you really realized that you had a brother, and in the sense of kind of here's another person that you really connected to with the chess games and your presence. What changed? What did you see in another person? What was the feeling that was different than you hadn't had before? What clicked?
Well, I guess if I could explain it well, it wouldn't hold as much significance. But
can I say that the words may be inadequate, okay, but it's helpful for us to have windows to know what makes a difference.
Yes, I understand that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, looking back, and it was a few years ago, we were both kind of non-aggressive, somewhat sensitive people, and he was very easygoing, and we would talk every now and then and simply lift our spirits in a place that felt very dead.
Mm-hmm.
So We sort of bonded over our similar somewhat passive but also genuinely it's just so hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. You felt it. It changed, and your smile and your eyes light when you talk about it.
Yeah, I just wish that I kept his number. I was gonna talk to him and play chess on the outside with him, but I lost his number, so that's unfortunate. But you know, he was a great friend in a place that was quite Darwinian and not very supportive,
mm-hmm,
in general. And this guy was unlike the other people there, who kind of just only cared / talked about themselves and were arrogant. He wasn't an arrogant person at all, despite his intelligence.
Uh-huh.
And I'm very respectful of him because of that. I've met at least one other person who is extremely intelligent and is not arrogant at all, very personable since I've got out. He was a PhD student in computer science at Cornell. His name is Adam, and he's a really amazing guy. No malintent that I can sense in mm-hmm. his mind.
Mm-hmm. He was a turning point person for you in some ways.
I think so. I think our friendships signified that there can be, I can make a genuine bond with someone else.
Yeah.
That it's possible to have a very meaningful relationship with another person.
Uh-huh. There's an intimacy there that you hadn't had before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That is very, very powerful. And may you have more.
Thank you. I feel like I've been doing my best recently to help other people, friends and family, and to solidify and strengthen our relationships in any way I can, to de-escalate situations,
mm-hmm.
and generally, I guess, provide humor. Humor is, I feel like it's one of the highest orders of our mental functioning. And I'm very happy that I've been able to partly develop a sense of humor.
You were about, when I interrupted with the music, you were about to I had asked you a question, or was asking a question, and also you were going to talk about a psychiatrist or a counselor who was particularly effective at connecting with you. Mm-hmm. What are the effective things that psychiatrists or your mother, who you had mentioned as a constant, what are the effective things that have kind of consistently either touched you or helped you to ground yourself or to just feel connected? What have they done? What are the things that they've done that have helped produce that?
Well, I guess when it comes to mental health professionals, I just get some sort of sense that they're not judging me. You know, I have been judged by mental health professionals before. It felt like I was kind of being put on the spot / labeled / you know, just treated as like a, I don't know, a piece
as an
of
object
cattle,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So these people were I just got the sense that they were like generally like interested in my well-being, and they. Very, very courteous people. They care about me, and I could sense that. It was great.
Yeah. So kindness is really ranks up there. That demonstrations of regard.
Yeah. But also a kind of firm ground too, and being very blatant, and of course those who have been able to match me intellectually or even supersede my intellectual ability just makes me respect them a little bit more.
So they're kind of fully, they're being who they are with you, and they're not pulling any punches, and they're not writing you off.
Yeah. And I mean, it's different with mental health professionals versus family members, because there is this barrier that mental health professionals have to erect, largely, I think, because they have seen or they will see patients who don't turn out well, so they can't become too emotionally invested.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess as for friends and family, they don't treat me as if I have some like defect in character,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that I'm they don't make fun of me. And I guess that has happened in the past with some of my close relationships, but
where they turned on you when things got rough for you.
Yeah, but seeing it from their perspective, it makes sense that they would say, oh, well, you turned on me first.
Yeah, no, I so you can do both perspectives, and that's, does that give you healing, or does that just give you more compassion for them?
I think both. It's just a realistic way to mm-hmm. look at the world, and I forgive them, and then they, hopefully after a while, realize that my antisocial behavior and weird mannerisms and sometimes disrespectful actions aren't meant personally, and so they become more invested in me, and I try to learn from these people and listen to them as to what I can do better. I used to kind of bounce ideas off some of my really good friends and family members, and they would say, oh, well, I don't think that's really happening, or yeah, that was a little bit rude, but you know, you're working on it, something like that. And I trust them. That's a major, major thing for people with mental illness, is
for you to be able to share those ideas with them and get feedback.
But generally to be able to trust other people,
uh-huh.
I was extremely headstrong, and I wasn't receptive to other perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that can very quickly turn one into an isolated individual and make one very cold.
Right. What did you learn that changed you, that made you more receptive to other perspectives? How did you change?
How did I change? Well, let's see. I realized that if I didn't stop using drugs and alcohol, and if I didn't go to therapy regularly, I would be in and out of the hospital for the foreseeable future, and I wouldn't have as great of a life in the end as I hope.
Mm-hmm.
And I also learned that the more times you get off medication / a relapse on drugs and alcohol, the less the chance that you'll be able to become, I guess, optimally healthy again.
Or the more medication it takes to manage your situation.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things I've heard. I don't
know. No, that's definitely true. I've heard that too.
Yeah.
So there are those things. And go ahead.
No, I wasn't saying it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think that it just takes time. It's very difficult to play this waiting game. When people have a psychotic disorder, the limbic system, primitive system of the brain is overactive, similar to how it is in teenager years. And people forget this higher, perhaps the highest cognitive function of prudence, which one of my favorite philosophers says is the source of all virtue. I found a lot of, I guess, comfort in some ways in philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
I view a lot of it as just kind of quibbling and semantics. Semantics and mm-hmm. kind of twisting words around, but a lot of it has given me some perspective. So
right, and it's given you something to. What I'm projecting into what you're saying is that it's given you something to work with, that can work. You can work at it at your own pace, because you can take it from the reading and then you can play with it. What does prudence mean to you?
Prudence, well, it means not reacting, not acting on first impressions. It means, viewing another human being as a compendium of good attributes and attributes that aren't so much evil as ones that are maladaptive. And it means looking out for people who have been in or are in a similar situation to me, and then trying to see past whatever front they present to those they relate to. And it means basically looking out for the future.
Mm-hmm. And looking with kindness at the whole picture. Like you said, not so much evil as just maladaptive.
Yeah, I think that's the most realistic way to view it. However, I think there is a limit to kindness,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, I think I've developed my self-confidence to the extent that I have a general idea of, what is doing good for a person, and understanding a person versus, what is too much, what is being being taken advantage of.
Or indulging, or, yeah. How do you sense that you're being caring versus being, or being putting up with too much from another person, or when you are indulging them too much, you know,
Sure. Well, I'm not as good as that as I'd like to be, but I think I'm improving.
I think most of us aren't as good as we'd like to be at that. That's a really tough judgment.
Yeah. But I mean, the first thing is to not react, like as I said earlier, on emotions, and you kind of have to sit with the situation. It can be painful, mm-hmm. It can be very painful, mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, it's important to I guess, you know, think about it and over the course of a couple of days, and you know, think about it at different times during the day, think about it in different mind states, like after exercise or meditation. And I think it's also really important to get other people's perspectives, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and value them, mm-hmm. because they're valuable.
Right. You described yourself as having developed enough confidence, mm-hmm. to come to this point where you can handle this prudent judgment of others, but also kind of beginning to set some limits, I would say, on what feels right, mm-hmm. for yourself. I have a friend who has kind of an implicit definition. The biggest issue in mental illness is the loss of confidence. Hmm. And then with healing comes the rediscovery of confidence, but confidence that's realistic given the limits and the challenges that one faces. But it allows one to have a place and to feel like you've got a place in the world and a purpose. What has happened that's helped you to begin to feel confidence? And did you feel it as a child ever? Is it coming back, or is it coming new?
I think both. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as I'm like not engaging in maladaptive behaviors, then, you know, I'll always be Ben Comore. But also, you know, I've grown, and so it's a little bit of both. Could you repeat the question again, please?
How has your confidence become? How have you become aware of your confidence?
How have you become aware of it?
How does it feel inside? What do you notice that's different now as you have become just a little more confident?
Well, there's a sense of security, self-assurance, and feeling empowered. Feeling like I can handle a lot of what befalls me, and it basically comes down to not looking for things outside of myself to be substantiated. And that was a main thing I was taught by Dr. Papperman. I built it largely when I went to school this past semester at the University of Rochester. In the beginning, it was extremely difficult. And then there was another one of these aha moments, which I would connect to the last song we might play. Mm-hmm. And, I just felt so empowered and free, and just, I had so many opportunities.
Getting on with your life.
Yeah, it's just like suddenly the glass was half full. It was amazing.
Yeah, and you've come back at this break, which could have been a breakdown time, uh-huh. and it hasn't been a breakdown time.
Yeah,
because you're taking it in a different way.
Yeah, really. And you know, at the end of the day, I can say to myself, "Wow, you know, I worked 3 to 5 hours." And then I visited people and talked with them and, as an equal, and I did this, and you know, that was a pretty good day. I'm proud of myself for what I accomplished, but not thinking too much about the past,
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's there's no excessive weight of the fast and no looming future.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because some people get tied up in either direction.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty common.
Yeah. So, if you had, would the younger you been able to have heard the kind of 14-year-old you, would there have been anything that you could have said to yourself or those around you that you think would have made a difference for you?
Yeah. Don't let me smoke pot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there was that, and you know, like, I don't know if anyone would have been receptive to that, but there's definitely that part.
Having heard that, you would have felt a little better.
Actually, I would have had it been told to those around me.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And myself. Yeah.
Right. So those are you could pull that out of your life, or at least take it at a greater distance.
If that hadn't happened, I would almost surely be better off today. It's difficult, though, and uh-huh. quite honestly, I don't like dealing with like what ifs.
No. I almost didn't ask the question for that reason. But I think it's something that will, and I think your challenging it is really helpful, because it will also allow people to stay with what is as opposed to what if. Now, what is the message that parents and friends need to hear when their children or their friends are beginning to see signs of mental illness issues? What messages would you want to share with people if you saw somebody in your situation going down the way you were? What are the messages you would want people to hear, knowing what you know now?
So if I saw someone who had signs of mental illness.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe some of the addiction, self-medication issues.
Right, right.
What would you say out of kindness to the people around that person?
Well, first of all, I'd be pretty diplomatic about it. I would just lay it out, you know, just this is what I see. I think it might not be good. I think it could damage the individual, and I don't see the problem in, you know, taking an hour and talking to a counselor about it. And if the counselor says it's fine and they have credentials, then there's no big worry. You know, I guess it depends on the illness too, and the person's manifestation of it, how functional they are in life too. Mm-hmm. And, I think that there's a lot of corruption, and I feel like in the United States today, and that there's a lot of corruption in the health industry, but that's one of the reasons why I didn't get help with this mental illness sooner, because
mm-hmm.
I was very much a anti-industry sort of person, anti-pharmaceutical.
Right. And when you say there's very much corruption, I mean, I hear you're saying that you don't trust, you didn't trust them to be able to help you.
Yeah, yeah, actually.
And that seems like that's a big hurdle people need to overcome inside themselves. You were going to say something. Right?
Yeah, it occurred and developed extremely fast. It's almost kind of impressive how fast this illness just kind of engulfed me and created a paradigm shift in my reality in the space of a couple of months.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so what happened?
What happened? Well, I guess I could.
And how did your relationships with the people around you change in those 2 months?
In the, well,
Is this when you came back from your first semester of college? When is this that you're talking about?
Sure. Yeah. It was in fall of 2011 when it started getting very bad. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, I'd made some friends and hung out with them, went to dinner with them, and so on and so forth. And then I started isolating. I think isolation is one of the main markers of chronic isolation of mental illness. And there are a couple other things too. This is called the prodromal phase, I think, before the illness completely develops. I remember walking into the food court and there was a TV, and it was playing a preview for the movie Puss in Boots, and I just couldn't stop laughing.
Mm-hmm. It just struck you as...
Yeah. and then I also remember, like, you know, it was just a weird, like, I don't want to say that this giant building that I was looking at felt like alive. It just seemed sort of imbued with some weird, like, abstract spiritual component. It was weird. I remember that too. Mm-hmm. And then just, I guess, hostility. And let's see, I exercised a lot, like every night, basically. A lot. But again, the main thing I feel is unnatural or maladaptive isolation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And associations with things that are beyond or not quite accurate.
Yeah.
You have said that you have learned how to question or to challenge those things. I think that's what I heard early on.
Mm.
What are the techniques? What are the things you've been able to learn to use when you feel like, is this something real? Is this something with me? Or is this something that my mental illness is projecting or that I'm experiencing is not the healthy side of me?
Sure. I mean, it's based in something called cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's about fighting, distortional / delusional thoughts with realistic thoughts, and the same for feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what else? Simply because I trust my loved ones, I can develop sort of a schema of what I'm prone to think that's not real, and what has some basis in reality. So I bounce ideas off of them.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's basically it.
And right, and the only thing that's different than in my hearing, people are bouncing. We're constantly adjusting our perceptions of the world by the feedback we're getting from others and what we're testing with them. Mm. And you've had, because you have been taken out of the realm of what was real in terms of your perceptions, you have to do that with more care. But it's not a skill that we all use that skill. We just don't have to rely on it with the same degree of care and caution that you're relying on it.
Mm.
Shall we cut to a piece of music and then come back?
Yeah, that's fine.
Which one should we play? We're going to have time for two more, so which should we play next?
Okay, let's play Hans Zimmer's Solomon.
Okay, from 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And that was Hans Zimmer and Solomon from the soundtrack of 12 Years a Slave. Our guest on this hour is Ben Comore. So, Ben, you wanted to comment on that song.
Yeah, I mean, I saw 12 Years a Slave shortly after I got out of one of my hospital stays. And my super great friends, parents, who are amazing people, Duncan Hilchey and Amy Christian, took me to 12 Years a Slave. And it was an extremely humbling experience. And I don't want to watch it again, particularly because there was one scene that was extremely painful for me to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like this song sort of signifies how I felt after I came out of the hospital that time, that there was this great path of carnage that I had largely created. A lot of chaos when I wasn't well, and it kind of embodies the tragedy of what happened, but also it almost seems to me like a song of rebirth, of you know, like being able to see more clearly with a new horizon. So that's why I picked it.
It's very powerful.
Yeah.
So Ben, the question that I close the show with is what do you do to kind of help take care of yourself intellectually, emotionally, and physically on a daily, regular basis? And also, I think in your case, you wanted to share something about what you try to do to help others. So what do you do? How do you manage?
Well, I think they're all interconnected. However, I usually wake up, and within half an hour to an hour, I start working, and after that, I hang out with friends and family. If I'm at school, maybe I'll go get something to eat and then come back. Let's see. So that's more intellectually. Emotionally, I think that animals, like particularly cats, are very therapeutic for me. I love cats. Even this cat Ikit that recently scratched me, I forgive him.
Yeah,
they're just so graceful, and dogs too. I have a new appreciation for my mom's dog Rosie. So physically, I recently stopped eating high processed sugar foods/ desserts because I have gained a fair amount of weight. So that's basically what I do physically. I know I should exercise more. Yeah.
Yeah, but don't guilt yourself.
Yeah. It's very difficult to lose weight, I feel like, because there's this feeling when you go on a diet that, you know, it feels like you're starving, like you're dying.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when you're not on the diet, you know, there are people who kind of give you this impression in society that you're not worth as much because you're overweight. And so you feel like in another sense that you're worthless.
Right.
And then you eat the food because in a very primitive sense, it makes you feel like you're satiated, you're living, you're important. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a cycle that goes on. I've been trying to break it.
It's a worthy thing to break it in yourself, and maybe together we can break it more, the implications of looks and judgments that may or may not need to be there.
Right.
Yeah. So, Ben, you've helped to kind of start a support group. Did you want to mention that? Or?
Sure. I could talk about that. And
then we're going to go to the last song because we're just running out of time.
No problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's called Rule of Thirds, and it's a peer support mental health group that I haven't had time in between semesters to recoup to hold meetings about, but it's definitely on my to-do list right now. I'm working on a website for mentally ill individuals who can't afford to see a doctor and buy pharmaceutical medication. So there's that. And I will get to Rule of Thirds in the summer. I promise, guys.
Yeah. And you can contact Ben through madeofclay.org, because this show will be on the website.
Sure.
And that way we can let you know.
Great.
Ben, you It has been wonderful to get to know you, and you brought a piece. You brought a last piece of music that we're going to close with, a John Williams piece.
Sure.
Do you want to talk about why that's important?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, the only redeeming feature of the 2 hours and 13 minutes of episode one, The Phantom Menace, was the 7 minute or so piece during which Darth Maul fights Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan Kenobi. And the instrumental is just a classic. It's amazing. It speaks to kind of the, I feel like, the fight between every individual, to between, you know, like, just instant gratification and pleasure versus doing what's just, doing what's right, doing what helps others. So yeah, that's what I feel like it.
And but also deeply, prudently gratifies oneself.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great word that you've reintroduced me to. Ben, it's been wonderful to get to know you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.